I think it's important to acknowledge that in these five patterns that we've been reflecting on, that these are all patterns of dissociation, and they're patterns of reactivity, and that they are interactive. You very rarely see one of these patterns standing alone, but rather they trigger each other and they reinforce each other. You know, if we take a simple example, you know, I might be sitting and just, you know, slightly bored or discontented, and this could trigger a pattern of craving for sensual pleasure. You know, I'll find something more interesting to do, and then if I'm a meditator, I might be quite judgmental about that and become quite aversive, you know, and then I'll find myself doubting my capacity to ever be awake, you know, and when that all gets too much, I'll just check out for a while, and then I'll come back and I'll, you know, be quite aversive to checking out, and I should be more, this is in Buddhist terminology, this is called samsara. This is called walking in circles of distress, you know. And the last of these patterns that we haven't really touched upon is the one of doubt, which is probably the most disabling one of all of these patterns. You know, this is not about the kind of doubt that is really helpful inquiry and questioning and probing and investigating, all of that kind of doubt that is really encouraged. This is paralyzing doubt. This is the doubt that doesn't allow us to make a commitment to anything at all. And when we can't make a commitment to anything at all, we cannot bring anything to fruition. And, you know, that doubt can manifest in so many ways in our life, whether it's, you know, doubt in our relationships, doubt in ourselves, doubt in the path, you know, doubt about the choices that we make in life. And we end up kind of suspended ambivalence, you know, really not committed to anything at all. And, you know, there's so much that underlies this pattern of doubt, you know, in terms of, you know, personal ideologies around capacity and possibility and capability. And, you know, it really does tie us in knots, you know, and I wish that there was an easy solution to doubt, but there isn't, because the only solution to doubt is actually experience, gain understanding, gain through experience. But we do learn to practice with doubt, you know, because you see it manifest in such sneaky ways, you know. You'll be on your walking path, you know, and after 10 minutes you're not quite sure you've chosen the right walking path, you know, and maybe I should be over there. But there's something about sustaining intentionality without becoming rigid or inflexible that is so crucial. You know, it might be that I'm making a commitment to sustaining an intention through a single walking period. You know, or it might be so simple as I'm making a commitment to sustaining attention through a single breathing, a single breath. You know, but it is that sense of the capacity to almost walk through the doubt, I think, that allows us to kind of get beyond its reach, to get beyond the grip of doubt. And it is a powerful one in many people's lives, where we're so conditioned to, you know, rely upon the reassurance of others to tell us that we're okay, you know, or that we're doing the right thing, you know, or to rely upon the approval or, you know, approving feedback from others to convince ourselves that we're doing the right thing. So there is a, you know, within this field of this kind of wavering, I think this sustained intentionality is actually so crucial. Without, as I say, without it becoming rigidity or inflexibility. We will probably come back to this a little bit later when we speak about investigation, because the Buddha talks about investigation as being one of the major healers of doubt. You know, to begin to actually see things as they actually are, and to draw our confidence upon that, rather than the narratives, the endless narratives that doubt generates. So I want to start talking about the bhujangas, the supports for awakening, the limbs for awakening. And as we do this, it's very important to remember that these qualities, again, they're not linear or hierarchical or developmental. It's not that I do energy and then I do joy. You know, it's not like that. These are ways of responding. These are capacities for responsiveness. You know, when you're in the midst of a hindrance attack, you know, in the midst of aversion or in the midst of agitation, the wisdom question is, what is going on here? And the compassion question is, what does this need? And when we start to look at what does this need, this is when we start to look to these limbs or supports of awakening and how we draw forth these qualities and develop them and cultivate them and bring them to some maturity. So to bear in mind, they're not linear, but they do have an embarkation point. And the embarkation point, the starting point, is, in Pali, this word, sati. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the etymology of this word, it's good to know that the early translators couldn't find a good translation for this word, sati. And it is the most frequently used word in the early discourses, sati. So struggling to find a good translation, which they couldn't do, they borrowed the word mindfulness from the Gospels. Okay? And now mindfulness has become, of course, so embedded in our culture, a word that is naturalized so much, that, you know, sometimes my apprehension is that this word sati actually loses its nuances. That mindfulness can become a sort of very one-dimensional word that is often associated with watching things. Sometimes it's reduced to just attentiveness. Whereas actually in the discourses, this word sati is never a standalone quality. It's also not a destination in itself. It's a vehicle for developing understanding. But it is always part of an extended family. It's why it's at the beginning of so many of the lists that you see in the early teachings. You see this word, they often begin with sati, because for anything to develop, we first need to be here and to be awake and to be aware. You know, it is the embarkation point for any process of transformation. So in this particular list, sati is the beginning, or seen often as the beginning of the supports for awakening, but its extended family in this particular listing is the quality of investigation, the quality of energy, the quality of joy, the quality of tranquility, the quality of collectedness, and the quality of equanimity. But I want to spend a little bit of time, and I'm sure many of you have got mindfulness up to the eyebrows, really, you know. So I want to spend a little bit of time kind of just re-examining how this word sati is used in the early teachings. And I want to do that mostly through use of similes, mostly through the use of many of the images associated with sati. But before I do that, I want to talk about the kind of four, what I consider to be the four kind of core nuances of sati. The first of these is what is sometimes referred to as simple knowing. This is quite a critical dimension of sati, the capacity to see things as they actually are, to know a thought as a thought, to know a sensation as a sensation, to know a feeling as a feeling, somewhat apart from our narratives, our descriptions, our interpretations, our evaluations. And the reason why it's such a critical aspect of sati is this is the first time that we actually begin to what is often called decenter or disidentify. We actually begin to form a dialogue with what is going on rather than being overwhelmed by it. So it's actually the first step in beginning to disidentify with contents of experience. I simply know it. There is the knowing of it. It's in this first nuance of mindfulness that we also begin to develop the attention faculty of sati. And the attention, you know, our capacity, I've spoken about this today, our capacity to sustain attention is actually so critical. So in a way, this is the attention muscle that we develop within the sati landscape. The second dimension is often referred to as protective awareness. This includes many things. It's not about... Can you hear me all right? It's not defensive awareness. This is about protecting the well-being of our own mind-heart. What are we protecting the mind-heart from? From the onslaught of the psychological and emotional patterns that don't serve us well. How do we protect the mind? By actually grounding ourselves in a present moment recollection, in the simple knowing, rather than being lost in the stories or the narratives. So this is often referred to as, I mentioned this morning, about learning to be our own gatekeeper. Part of this protective awareness also includes the element of restraint. Restraint is different than suppression. It's different than aversion. It's actually knowing how to restrain the sense doors. And I will go into this in some of the similes that I will use. For many people, the first part of their practice, and I'm talking maybe the first 20 years, is actually spent in developing these two aspects of sati. These two aspects of mindfulness. How not to get lost in the storms, how to learn to ground ourselves in a present moment recollection, how to sustain our attentiveness in the present moment. We can spend a very, very long time, and it's well spent time, in these first two domains.
Can I just ask you to repeat again what you said, protecting from the onslaught of psychological, emotional...
habit patterns that don't serve us well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The third of these is investigative awareness. Now, clearly, investigative awareness, which I will go into again in the similes, really relies upon the foundation of these first two. Because if we don't have the foundation of some inner stillness and stability, we know that investigation often turns into obsession and rumination and thought repetition and just recycling old stories. But this quality of investigation is often said to be one of the most important factors of awakening. And it has much to do with the fourth nuance of sati, which is about reframing cognition. Or reframing our views, which is really about changing the lens through which we see the world and through which we see ourselves. The most common way that this is often referred to in the discourses is actually through the cultivation of metta, through the cultivation of boundless friendliness, where suddenly that which has been perceived as an enemy can actually be befriended. But of course, this reframing of views filters right through the cultivation of awareness, because much of the practice is also concerned
with reframing our views of how we see life, for example, as, you know, putting on, seeing life through the lens of impermanence, of dukkha, of non-self, rather than seeing life through the lens of permanence and forever, and through, you know, seeing the, you know, endlessly trying to evade dukkha, or trying to posit an eternal independent self-existence in all things. So it's reframing the lens, but even on a more psychological, personal level, it's actually reframing the lens through how we view ourselves. You know, these fixed views that we can carry about who we are. You know, I'm an anxious person, you know, I'm an aggressive person, or I'm a failure, or I'm an extrovert, or I'm an introvert. It's kind of reframing these views that get very held in place through often the hindrance factors and through clinging. Okay? So it's reframing views. This is also reframing views of how we see the people who come in and out of our lives, because I'm sure you're aware of the tendency that we can have to reify things very quickly, to fix views very quickly about ourselves and about others. You know, you only need a person to come in late twice and you've got a view. That's the person who was always late. You see them 10 years later, you don't see the person. So you actually see the person who always comes in late. Okay? So this is about bringing a certain fluidity. There are two major jobs of sati. Well, there's many major jobs of sati, but what I would say is two of the very major jobs of mindfulness. The first of them is to cut the link that seems so automatic between the feeling tone of experience, the pleasant and the unpleasant, and the neither pleasant nor unpleasant, to cut the link that seems so automatic between the feeling tone of experience and the underlying patterns of reactivity, of wanting or aversion or dismissal. Now, those patterns, of course, just, you know, can govern much of our lives, can't they? You know, I see, hear, feel, taste, touch, smell something pleasant, I'm moving towards. You know, I hear, see, feel, taste, sense, touch, think something unpleasant, and we see the impulse to move away and to push away. Huh? Seems so automatic. And of course, that reactivity then can govern our lives and make us feel very, very, very bound to these habit patterns that feel so embedded and fixed. So that's the first major task of sati, is that it begins to sever that link, because we can know the pleasant as pleasant. We can know the unpleasant as unpleasant. We develop the skill and the capacity to protect the mind from the invasion of those underlying patterns. So the first job of sati is to begin to cool the impetus and the force of craving and aversion and delusion. Is that clear? So are you with me on that? Second major job of sati is to clean up the field of perception. Because many of our views become actually embedded in our perceptions. You know, the way that I see something, the way that I see you. You know, I only need to see you. And the perception is loaded and charged, not only with history, but with emotional memory. Which means that I very rarely see anything anew at all in this life. What I do see is a repetition of historical ways of seeing or experiencing something, and the repetition of the emotional memory tied in with those perceptions. So the second major job of sati is almost to strip perception of these loaded emotional memories that prevent us from seeing anything at all freshly.
You know, William Blake once put it, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. What we see is when the doors of perception are loaded with association, the world appears very finite. I know you. I know this. And there's much involved in us keeping those kind of loaded perceptions in place, because this is also what seems to offer us some ability to keep the world safe, predictable, known, and therefore in control. Okay. So these four nuances of sati and these two primary functions of sati. Okay? You any questions about that? No? Yeah.
Cleansing the emotional history, when everything in the world is relational and we are vulnerable as others, and
cleansing perception of fixed emotional reactivity is probably a better way of putting it. It's not like we erase the past.
Yeah.
We don't erase the past, you know. We don't erase histories of injury, and some of those are quite good to keep, you know, in place. But it's clearing the perceptual field of fixed emotional reactivity and view.
Fixed.
Otherwise, nothing is allowed to change. Nothing is allowed to be seen anew. Nothing is allowed to surprise us. So we cut off when perception is loaded with fixed emotional reactivity and view, we actually cut off our capacity to learn. Which is quite major. Teresa. Of anything that's fixed.
Oh, I like you or I don't like you, all of it?
Yeah, anything that's fixed. It doesn't mean that we don't have any responsiveness. We might still really like something, or we might find ourselves really perhaps not liking something. But we're not confining it within a view that this is who you are, you know, this is how I rely upon you staying the same, by the way. You know, I'm going to keep liking you as long as you keep aligned with my view of you. You know, and if that alters, you know, suddenly my world is turned upside down.
Mm-hmm. So how does mindfulness erode that process?
Well, because this... Oh, yeah. How far do you want to go with that? How far do you want to go with that? Okay, so then we get into one of the really core cognitive chains.
Excuse me, could you just repeat what you said?
Sorry. How does mindfulness actually begin to liberate those fixed views, okay? How does it cleanse perception or clear perception of fixed view? Well, that gets really quite interesting because we get into one of these. The Buddha was such a good map maker, you know, and the point of a map is it actually kind of gives us some sort of directions to follow so that we don't get lost. And one way that he was a really good map maker was the maps of cognitive process. So here's a very core one, because the Buddha said if you're going to... I'm talking to you. The Buddha said if you're going to understand how suffering comes into being, how distress comes into being, you need to understand the architecture of distress. And if you're going to understand the architecture of distress, you need to understand the architecture of your own world of experience, how your personal world of experience is constructed moment to moment. Because in that map, there are the keys of the way out of that closed cycle. So it starts with where there is contact, there is feeling. Then it changes. What we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we think about. Are you interested in this?
Yeah.
What we perceive, we think about, proliferate about, dwell upon, and what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind, and the shape of our world. It's a basic chain of world construction that can happen in the space of moments. And it is a chain of construction that means that my personal world is different than your personal world. But of course I believe that my personal world of experience is the correct one. So what we contact, we feel. Notice these two are ethically neutral. There's nothing personal about this. Contact is simply the process of touching and being touched by the world. The eyes touch a sight and there is seeing. The ears touch a sound and there's hearing. The body touches a sensation, has a sensation, and there's sensing. But of course, in this, the mind is the sixth sense door. And the mind is touched by a thought or an image, and there's thinking or imagining. So it's quite ethically neutral. This is simply being a part of being an alive human being. Now, every moment of that touching has a feeling tone. It's either pleasant, or it's unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. What comes next? What we feel, we perceive. We have a name for. This is all pre-verbal. It's all pre-verbal. This is when we're moving more into the personal world. So look at how the language changes. Instead of when there is contact, there is feeling. What we feel, we perceive. So we have a name for. A deer, or a bird, or my knee, or Sally Joe over there. You know, what we feel, we perceive. Now, notice how these two are tied together. So, perception is actually influencing the feeling tone. So, if Sally Joe has arrived 3 times late, I only need to see Sally Joe, and the feeling tone of that eye contact is actually unpleasant. If Sally Joe's my best friend, the feeling tone of that contact through my eyes is actually pleasant. So perception is influencing feeling, but feeling is influencing perception. Because if something is unpleasant, we start to search our emotional memory banks of how to identify that unpleasantness. Okay? So perception is when we start to have a name for something. We start to have a name for it. What we perceive, we think about. We proliferate about, we dwell upon. Have you noticed that happening? You know? Oh, Sally Jo, well, she must be this kind of person. I wonder why she's like that. You know, she came from a broken home or a bad family, you know. She has no manners, you know. I would never do that, you know. So we start to think about and proliferate about and dwell upon. Can you feel what is happening in consciousness in that process? How consciousness is contracting and shrinking. It's a process of beginning to become identified with the process that's going on. But in that, there's a kind of shrinkage going on where we actually can't see anything about Sally Joe except what perception is telling us about her and the view that is being formed. What we think about, we dwell upon. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. Becomes the shape of our mind. So there's a lot coming in with perception. There's probably the hindrance factors are probably coming in. Emotional history is probably coming in. So there's a lot coming in with perception, and it's actually starting to shape the mind of the moment. You know, the mind of anxiety, or the mind of aversion, or, you know, the mind of agitation. And the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our world. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not just Sally Jo who irritates, but I'm going to think about all the irritations in this life. You know, and look at how irritating the world is. She was always intruding upon my space, you know, and I'm kind of helpless in this. Becomes the shape of our world. Okay, so what is mindfulness doing? Well, mindfulness is actually coming in here, if we're fortunate. If we're fortunate. In some Buddhist imagery, I am so off track here. in some Buddhist imagery, the six sense doors are portrayed as being the five open windows and the open door of the house. So the five open windows are the usual five familiar sense doors, and the open door of the house is the mind. The sense door of the mind. So the world is flowing in through those open windows and doors, and the world of reactivity or responsiveness is flowing out through those open windows and doors. So where do we sit mindfulness? On the windowsill. We sit mindfulness on the windowsills, we sit mindfulness on the doorsill. This is where we establish our capacity to simply know. It's where we establish protective awareness. It's where we establish investigative awareness. Maybe Sally Jo's not always like that, you know? And it's where we begin to reframe view or cognition. This is how mindfulness works to clean up the field of perception. The short story.
That really was the fast track story of how mindfulness cleans up the world of cleans up the doors of perception. Yes, please.
I think you made the comment that you were, if we're lucky, the mindfulness.
Yes. Okay. I'll go back. If we're lucky. If we're well trained. If we're well trained, if the mind is well trained, it sits on the windowsills and the door sills of the house. But if we end up down here proliferating and thinking and dwelling upon, it is never too late, okay? Because mindfulness is part of an extended family. And it's in these links, when we find ourselves proliferating and obsessing and dwelling, that we may actually be drawing upon some of the relatives of mindfulness. Remember the compassion question? What does this need? The wisdom question? What is going on here? The compassion question? What does this need? Where we might be drawing on some of the other qualities that are part of the mindfulness family. So it's actually never too late. And it's not a question of luck.
Something that we're there's something wrong with us that we're having them, we need to, you know, get rid of them and that kind of thing. I think what you're saying, perhaps I'm wrong about this, but is as we develop these skills with compassion, etc., acceptance of the experience, we can get more skilled and more, I guess the mindfulness moves up sooner in the whole process. But there's this part, I think we feel like, oh dear, I'm ashamed that I'm dissociative or I'm having, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So the question is around how often in the way that we frame things, the hindrances are basically telling us something is wrong with us, or something is wrong with our practice, or inadequate about our practice. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that the hindrances are not actually signaling that. The hindrances are part of this spectrum that goes right back to ignorance or confusion, that when we don't know better, you know, or haven't learnt the skills, we are basically at the mercy of emotional reactivity, and we know this to be true in ourselves and in others. So actually you can think of a lot of meditative training actually as skill training, but skills that direct us in the direction of awakening, not at getting over the hindrances, but at waking up. And a big part of that skill training, I would say, is the cultivation of the limbs or the supports of awakening.
So you're on the hindrances, because I've sort of gotten stuck on this a bit too. Because you kind of get this idea that hindrances are bad and when they happen and all of this sort of stuff. So you're talking more about recognizing them.
Yes.
As opposed to,
yes.
Getting rid of them.
But we have. Oh yes, you will. Oh yes, you will get rid of it. I don't want to use the language. Oh yes, you will get rid of the hindrances. But you should really anticipate that as you develop an understanding, deepen an understanding, begin to calm and cool the fires of greed and hatred, begin to illuminate confusion with understanding. You should certainly anticipate that the most visible manifestation of all of that and the hindrances will fade from your emotional landscape.
Fade.
And disappear.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's really important to lift the bar a little bit, you know. Because I think there's the two extremes of either shaming yourself over the hindrances and getting busy and thinking, oh, I have to get rid of them. But the other extreme is a kind of acceptance that has a sort of element of passivity in it, you know, that I just need to learn to live with the hindrances. Hmm? And I think in there's a middle path where the Buddha is very clearly pointing out the unshakable liberation of the heart. And the unshakable liberation of the heart means a liberation from the grip of greed, hatred, delusion, the hindrances, and confusion. So there's a definite sense of direction and aspiration here. And actually, I don't think we should doubt that. You know, I mean, I see people who are well experienced in practice, but I also see people actually who have really committed regular practice. They don't expect to come on retreats and have hindrance attacks anymore. That's not the expectation anymore, that I'll go on retreat and spend my first 2 days, you know, lost in the hindrances. That expectation disappears, which is interesting. There was one more. Yeah.
Well, when I was listening to all the five hindrances, it made me think, I was thinking about how the hindrances are actually helpful.
How?
Huh? Well, like when you were talking about, like, when people are going through really hard times, like Ashla, the great bliss goddess, her head explodes, right? And then she gets to have 10 heads because they keep exploding because she's looking at the suffering of the world. And, you know, and luckily, you know, according to the story, she keeps growing more heads, but we don't only have one head, so we have the hindrances so that we get to keep our heads sometimes, you know? And so I was just thinking about how, you know, we have these nervous systems and we've come up with these ways of surviving this, you know, difficult world.
So the question is around the benefits of the hindrances.
So, I mean, I understand that there's, you know, being reactive, there's better ways, but, you know, there's also how people have used these hindrances, like children, to survive, right?
I mean, I think I'd be going a bit too far to really start speaking about the benefits of the hindrances. They have been survival mechanisms at times for people, you know, particularly, for example, dissociation in trauma is sometimes a survival mechanism for a period of time, but it doesn't become a habit pattern. It's when the hindrances really become patterns rather than responses that they're actually not necessarily so useful anymore. For example, if a child is in distress, you would want to provide some comfort. Or if we're in distress, you know, it's sometimes really very good, you know, to go home and take a hot bath and say, rather than saying, oh, well, that's sensual craving, you know. It's sometimes really skillful to do that, you know. If we're faced with some, you know, huge injustice in the world, it's really good to feel deeply disturbed and say no, you know. But these I don't really recognize necessarily as being hindrance habit patterns. I think of them more as ways of skillfully and appropriately responding to what is in front of us and asking the compassion question of what is needed. See, the problem with the hindrance patterns, as I've been talking about it, is they're not optional, they're not chosen. They're more in the realm of compulsions, more in the realm of habit patterns that repeat themselves without any sense of intentionality in them at all. So I think it's good to make that distinction about where there is a sense of intentionality in the responses. You know, I'm really wiped out, I've had a really terrible day, I'll go home and have a hot bath. You know, and think, well, that's really okay. You know, there's an intentionality there rather than saying, I had such a crap day, you know, I'm just going to go home and drown myself in some sort of craving so that I don't think about it. You know, one is a way of taking care of oneself, and one is an avenue of forgetfulness. You know, I think it's really important to make that distinction. We're moving on, Miss Sati. Okay, so what I'd like to talk about Sati in a different way today, because I'd like to talk about Sati through some of the similes and the images that are used and scattered through the text. Oh, by the way, we'll just go for about another 15 minutes and then we'll take a walking period, okay? Because you're probably ready for that. So here's the first of these similes that's used to describe Sati. A person who's stuck in a thicket of thorns, who's moving very carefully so they don't further entangle themselves or get hurt by the thorns. Can you get a sense of that one? You're caught in a really dicey situation. So instead of just kind of trying to rip yourself out of it, you know, and get further stuck in this, you know, blackberry thicket, you're so careful about how you unhook yourself. Can you get a sense of that quality of mindfulness and where you might use it? Or where you might draw upon that aspect of mindfulness. Say you're stuck in a really difficult, say, family dynamic. You know? And the impulse might be to suddenly try and tear yourself out of it. And in doing so, you make the dynamic much more tangled. And you hurt yourself or maybe others in the process. I mean, that's kind of one example I would think of. So, there's two ways in which this simile of the gatekeeper is used. So the gatekeeper is standing at the gates of the city. The city is the mind heart, okay? The gatekeeper standing at the gates of the city, awaiting the messengers to arrive from afar. When they arrive, unfamiliar with the city, the gatekeeper helps them to deliver their message as swiftly and as immediately as possible to the king or queen of the city. Okay, so the gatekeeper standing at the door of the mind. The sense impressions are flowing in. The job of mindfulness is to deliver those messages without being distracted on the way, directly to consciousness, without picking up a whole lot of unnecessary baggage on the way. Can you get a sense of that? I mean, this also has something to do with how the king or queen is able to respond, also through that undistracted, direct means. Do you have a sense of how that plays out? The second image of the gatekeeper is the gatekeeper stands at the gates of the city. And the job of the gatekeeper is to welcome into the city all of those visitors who mean to serve the city well. Okay? And actually to acknowledge, but to not invite into the city all of those visitors who are intent on doing harm to the city or its inhabitants. So this is bringing in to the landscape of mindfulness, this most important element of discernment. Okay? Discernment. There's too much association of mindfulness being a sort of passive observation. Whereas actually discernment is what rescues mindfulness from passivity. Discernment is the link between mindfulness and skillful effort or skillful response. So discernment in Buddhist psychology is a skill we develop almost on its own. On a basic level, it could be presented as being able to discern what is the difference between what is helpful and unhelpful, the difference between what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Without that discernment, the gates of the city are just wide open. When we think of the term, can you wait 5 more minutes before we have? When we think of this distinction, you know, because when we use the words wholesome and unwholesome, you know, it's sometimes hard to get a sense of what that actually means. You know, I think in my generation, wholesome means Pollyanna, you know. Some of you are too young to know about Pollyanna. And your learning wouldn't be enriched by knowing about Pollyanna. But wholesome can have this connotation, you know, of niceness, you know. Wholesome is something very different than that. In Buddhist psychology, the distinction between what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, or skillful and unskillful, can be measured by a few very simple questions. Okay, a thought, an impulse arises, speech arises, actions are beginning to arise, and we ask of them a few simple questions. Does this lead to my affliction, or the affliction of others, or the affliction of both? Does this lead to the end of my affliction, and the affliction of others, and the affliction of both? So first two questions for discerning what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. Second question, does this lead to the deepening of my understanding, the understanding of others, and the understanding of both? Or does this lead away from the deepening of understanding of myself or others or both? Third question. Does this obstruct wisdom or enable wisdom of myself, others, and both? Last question. Does this lead towards a greater sense of freedom of myself, others, and both? Or does it lead away from a sense of freedom within myself, others, or both. Okay, few simple questions for beginning to sense what is wholesome and unwholesome, what is skillful and what is unskillful. There's another question I would bring in here. Does this fall within the field of something that is intentional, or does this fall within the field of something that feels far more compulsive? A compulsion. Intentional or compulsive? Another question. Is this thought, word, act, or choice, is it rooted in kindness, in compassion? Or is it rooted in aversion and ill will or greed? So it's a lot of questions, you know. It's quite, I mean, we could probably go on, but I do feel like this is such an important element within mindfulness cultivation, you know, because it's on the basis of those questions that we actually bring appropriate response, you know, rather than reactivity or compulsion. And I think it's on the basis of those questions that we actually make skillful choices and bring skillful efforts into our lives. So this just gatekeeper element of mindfulness is absolutely, I feel, really critical. Without it, mindfulness just gets, you know, if you think about it, just gets reduced to this observing. You know, if I go out on the street and I see somebody hurting an animal, you know, that animal is not helped very much by my capacity to, hearing, you know, and just being mindful. That animal's not helped very much by that. You know, what enables me to contribute well is actually to make that bridge between what is seen and how what is seen is responded to, both inwardly and outwardly. So please don't sacrifice discernment. You know, I do feel that, you know, one of the kind of, you know, the dangers perhaps in some contemporary presentations of mindfulness where it's so presented as this non-judgmental seeing, you know, that it can become this kind of like, you know, that judgment becomes associated with discernment and becomes always this kind of negative characteristic, you know, and then discernment gets sacrificed. We do have value judgments. You know, as human beings, we're asked to have value judgments. You know, I think the way that judgment has become so loaded in our vocabulary is actually unhelpful to us.